Tonight's talk is on the two kinds of wisdom, or two facets of wisdom, sometimes called the complementary facets of wisdom. And this would not likely be a talk that you have heard from someone, because I've never heard it from anyone. But it's possible. It's possible. I've certainly not heard all the Dhamma talks that have been done here or elsewhere, so possible. And to talk about these two facets of wisdom, or two kinds of wisdom, I'm going to use my own experiences in this last couple of months as an illustration, because this class was founded, this Sangha was founded on the idea that we would talk about living the Dhamma in daily life, and this can maybe serve as a good example. So 2 months ago, I was up in Mendocino County, with right there along the coast, staying with friends of mine, Fred and Cheryl, and I'd gone up there because it was on my first vacation. Genuine vacation in over a year. And I'd gone up there the first day of my vacation on a Friday and had a wonderful time. And one of the things I was doing was claiming my time ritually from having stepped down as co-guiding teacher at Spirit Rock, because it really has made a difference in how much time I have. But I haven't really had the I was filling other obligations, and as you know, I've had a breathing problem that's gone on for 2¾ years now, and it's not over. It's still finding its own way. And but I'd spent this day of Friday doing a great deal of ritual, quite happily doing ritual for myself. I have a number of different things that I do that I've developed over so many decades. And so I woke up Saturday morning, quite spacious from having done this. Like, oh yes, I have my time now. I have, like, I am not just my responsibilities. I've moved beyond being just my responsibilities. And out of this, I was staying in, they have a little one-room guest cottage, and I was staying there, and the whole time there had been this basketball outside this little guest cottage. And I'd looked at it over and over again. And the only reason that this is true is that I, like so many people in the Bay Area, had become quite the devoted fan of the Warriors basketball team. So I was looking at that basketball, and I was calculating how many decades it had been since I had touched a basketball. And it was more than 5 decades, over 50 years. And I, out of nowhere, thought, well, I'll just go up there, because on their driveway, they have a basketball goal and all. I'll just go up there and shoot a few hoops on my way in to breakfast with them. And so off I go to do this. In this very free feeling of spaciousness, right? And I get up there, and I'm picturing Steph Curry. I don't know if you know him. I'm going because I feel so in my body. But having not shot a basketball in all of those decades, it did not go where I intended at all. And so it's like going to go rolling back down the hill, which has no consequence whatsoever if it goes rolling down that hill. But out of my surprise that I so missed not just the basket, but the backboard and everything, I responded in a reactive way. You've heard me teach it here a number of times about reactive versus responsive mind. I responded in a reactive mind, and somewhat impulsively went running after that basketball when it had gone off the court, and it was now on a series of rocks. It's a rock patio that have a kind of, they've turned up a little bit. I go running out there. First of all, I'm wearing these slippers that are not basketball shoes at all, and they're too big for me. And so I run and I trip on the rock just as I've got my right arm extended like this, and I hit on it. And it turns out the basketball was still there after this was all over. So I must have caught the basketball, but it's possible that I also had my hand on the basketball when I landed, and that added to the severity of the situation. I don't know, because I blacked out. And I came to some minutes later groaning. And I had, as it turned out, broken the shoulder at the humerus knob as part of the shoulder joint. I'd broken it horizontally and vertically on both sides, and then diagonally from the back down to the front. So this was, you know, an event. And it turned out there were a number of other secondary body things that had happened because of this, some of which I really was not aware of until some days, because there was a predominant pain. And you know how when there's predominant pain, other pains aren't noticeable? So it's been a kind of little series of surprises, you know, as it's gone on. So that was the event. I will come back to this, but within 10 minutes, when I really was like, there was a lot of bleeding from my nose, and a lot of, anyway, there's a lot of secondary issues. So it took me 10 minutes to get oriented at all. And they heard me groaning, they came and got me on a table and so forth. And, but after 10 minutes, I had this clarity. Oh, this is really, this is an event. This is a changing event. My life was like this, and now it's like this. And I made that transition, just as we talk about in the Dharma. It was like this, now it's like this. Because of that, this just switched. Just switched. No anger at myself, no, if only, no matter what if, all of that. And so that began this adventure that will be woven into this talk tonight. As you know, the teachings of the Four Noble Truths have been so important to me, and, you know, in the Dancing with Life book that a number of you have read, the whole book is just an exploration of the Four Noble Truths. In the book, I talk repeatedly in terms of the first noble truth is to be penetrated by feeling the truth of dukkha, feeling what I call feeling the ouch of dukkha. In the same way. I was actually going to just read those to you for a moment, but I've never actually looked them up in the paperback. So many more appendixes in the paperback. So the first noble truth says, you know, what is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, and so forth. And then the first insight, there is this noble truth of suffering. Such was the vision, insight, wisdom, knowing, and light that arose in me. This is the Buddha talking about things not heard before. Because the Four Noble Truths were his, that were his. All of these meditation states, all of the practice of loving kindness and so forth, he had learned from other teachers. These what are called deep absorption states, jhana states. He learned the first group of jhana states, deep absorption states, from his first teacher, and then he learned the other more subtle ones from his second teacher. So the Buddha did not invent everything that we think of as part of in Buddhism, or discover it, or rediscover it, or whatever word you want to use. He was part of already, he built on something that was already flourishing. Particularly among the Jains, we could also say. So then, so the first insight of the first noble truth is in this. This is the Samyutta Nikaya version of the Four Noble Truths, which presents them as 12 insights, and very useful way to understand them. because it really, we can get our hands around them as 12 insights. They get fuzzy if they're all sort of lumped together. So the first insight is there is dukkha. That's an intellectual proposition. The practice insight is as follows, and it's the second insight of every noble truth. The noble truth must be penetrated to by fully understanding suffering, to feeling the ouch of suffering. And so the four noble truths, each has three insights, and each of the insights, each of the practice, the second insight of each of the four noble truths has to do with penetrating. We're penetrating the four noble truths. A few weeks ago, or 2 months ago or sometime, not that long ago, time is long gone as a reference point, I was doing a Dharma talk one evening on a retreat, and I was talking about this penetration as wisdom, how that the feeling was one of penetration, that you penetrate into, you have insight into. It's a triangular kind of energy. It's like it's in Aikido, it would be the kind of blend where we blend. We use that triangle energy. It's like that. It's like the way I'm making with my hand. It's penetrating into. It's not surrounding like this. It's not like that. It's penetrating in, and it takes a lot of going over each of these noble truths over a long period of time for most of us. To really get the depth of wisdom that comes from each insight. But it's available to us. And even a little bit of understanding of each of these makes such a difference. So this penetrating, having wisdom by penetrating the truth of things, was one of the two things that brought me to practice. I really wanted to understand. I wanted to understand what was this reality that I was living in. I did not come to Dharma because of dukkha. I had found my way with the truth of dukkha. And that there's sort of three main gates. One is the dukkha, what to do about suffering in life. The second main gate or doorway is the truth of anicca, that things are always changing. And the third is that trying to understand what am I, what the truth of anatta, anatta, not self, meaning what is our real nature and so forth. So it was this anatta, this not selfness that really brought me to the Dharma. I wanted to understand, well, what is here and all? And so that was my motivation. And I was seeking wisdom. So that's my first motivation. And then my second motivation was I wanted some sort of well-being that was conditioned only upon my own development and understanding, and was not well-being that was dependent on conditions. Because quite early in life, I had learned that conditions are not reliable for a sense of well-being. That's why I'd worked this out about dukkha so early, because I had lots of practice and had the kind of mind that happened to respond that way. Just good fortune. So that's this nature, the nature of the wisdom that comes through the Four Noble Truths. That wisdom is very empowering, but by itself, it can be a little limiting in the sense that it can get dry. It can be, one can move away from life, from that, where one kind of goes. The tendency in that way would be towards a kind of nihilism or something from this, or disassociation with life. So There is a second kind of wisdom, and this is called vast wisdom, V-A-S-T, vast wisdom. And I'm going to read you, in the Buddha's words, these differences, and this is from the Anguttara Nikaya. If one has heard that this is dukkha, and through wisdom, moreover, rightly sees dukkha as it really is, if one has heard of the arising of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, there's skipping things here to make it short, the path to cessation of dukkha, and with wisdom, moreover, rightly sees the path to the cessation of dukkha as it really is, then in this way, one is learned with penetrative wisdom. If you have seen the dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the path that leads to the end of dukkha, and the benefits of the end of dukkha, then you are learned with penetrative wisdom. It's penetrative wisdom. You have the kind of wisdom that is seen through the surface level. Clear enough? It's all about the Four Noble Truths in this way. Now, here's the other from the same teaching. If one does not think of harming oneself, does not think of harming others, does not think of harming both, and instead one thinks of benefiting oneself and of benefiting others, benefiting many people out of compassion for the affliction in the world, seeking what is meaningful and of benefit for devas and humans, seeking their ease and happiness, then in this way, one is bright, intelligent, and with vast wisdom. So penetrative wisdom is the path to freedom. Vast wisdom is the compassionate response to what is. So from our compassion practice, we see, we have a natural response of from seeing the dukkha, and that natural response we call compassion, or all the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, the four heavenly abodes, like the abodes of the gods, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Equanimity is there to balance out. Because if you don't have equanimity, if you have compassion, you can get lost in it. If you have sympathetic joy, you can be unskillful in it. If you have metta, you can be unskillful. So the equanimity keeps us in balance. So there's penetrative wisdom and this vast wisdom. And in our daily life, the Dharma in daily life, we would wisely cultivate both. From penetrative wisdom, with penetrative wisdom, we can have an experience that is dukkha, breaking one's shoulder in three places, and have it be an experience that is not disruptive to well-being. With vast wisdom, one doesn't go into regret or recrimination against oneself for having done something that was absolutely silly, absolutely mindless, and absolutely stupid, and not have any feeling about any of that, nor feeling along the way, because one has compassion, one has a natural compassion through practice of compassion. So there is a balance from seeing that things change. That's anicca. Everything changed. There was dukkha, there's dukkha. And I don't have to identify with any of it. That's all penetrative wisdom, right? Without the compassion, one can fall into judgment, or if only, or feeling sorry for oneself, and so forth. So in living the Dharma in daily life, we're cultivating penetrative wisdom and vast wisdom. Clear enough? Mm-hmm. Everybody with me? Okay. Then When I waited 48 hours to go to the surgeon, to have this attended to, it all made sense to me to wait. Because I was way up in Mendocino and I was going to take that road back, and I didn't know who I would see in the emergency room, and would they want to do something right away that I preferred the pain to having more choice in a measured way. So I waited 48 hours. So I go into the surgeon. This is the surgeon, same surgery group that had done my knee surgery. I go in there on a Monday morning, and I wasn't sure it was broken. I just knew it hurt a lot. And so the x-ray technician is moving my body around, and then he sees the x-ray, and he goes, "Why are you not cursing at me?" And I said, "Why would I be cursing at you?" He said, "This is a terrible break. I must be really hurting you when I move you around." And I said, "No, I'm already hurting. I wouldn't say you're adding to it." And so then I go see this surgeon, and he says, he's looking at this thing, at the x-rays, and he turns to me and says, "So what did you do?" And I start to tell him about that I was playing basketball. He says, "No, what did you do?" And I said, I don't understand what you're asking me. He says, "What did you do with this pain for 48 hours? And I said, "Well, I took ibuprofen, and then I sat and watched it." His eyes just glazed over. No interest, right? Understandably. But did I stop? No. I said, "You know, like when I had my meniscus caught in the condyles of my knee, every time I would rip it more, there was this sharp pain, like the triangle pain. It was sharp, and I'd say it would, like, in any given moment, it would take over the reality. But this pain, in any given moment, is different because it's round, and it's getting worse, right? All of my credibility is going away. It's round, and so it's not the sharpness. It's not like a sharp pain where it takes your head off. It's the quantity and constancy of it that is the problem. Any given moment, it's not that bad, but boy, does it not stop. No interest in this. And understandably so, but I really needed to sell somebody this, right? I wanted to share my insights, so I just went right ahead. I didn't need him to understand it. That was practice in daily life, you see. There was a predominant condition arising repeatedly. I couldn't do anything about it. So as best I was able, I stayed with the experience of it. As best I was able. And, at times it had me, you know, and other times it was just pain. But there was no second arrow. There was no reactive mind to what was already there. My mind was not going anywhere other than with this hurts. So there was no like how stupid, oh, this means that, I will lose this, I will lose that, which I did. I didn't get to do things that I had planned to do that I really wanted to do, including getting to Adrian Ross, my colleague from Canada, and I, who have taught at Cloud Mountain for 16 years in a row. This was our last time to be there together, and I didn't get to go. So there was loss, and I felt loss in all this, but I didn't feel recrimination around the loss. I didn't feel it was just loss throughout. So anyway, this was the beginning of this experience. And the kindness with the kindness with the penetrating understanding of it is what caused me not to get irritated with myself, not to get disappointed with myself, not to do that teaching of the second arrow, or sometimes called translated as the second dart, that so many of you would be familiar with, and which you could tell others about. And so as we go through life, we start to see the practice showing up in our life in a very practical, real way, living the Dharma in daily life, just as we do in here. For myself, as I said, I was motivated for penetrative wisdom. That's what I was looking for. My own experience with this vast wisdom has come sort of by accident. I was not seeking that kind of understanding. But over the years, in part through the Brahma Vihara practices, those four practices that I named of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, those qualities started to emerge more. And just seeing life with penetrative wisdom, a natural response is compassion. Because this is a very tough realm in which to live. You know, all these things go wrong all the time. Nothing's reliable. And the immense amount of stupidity we have as a species is speechless. You know, it cannot be comprehended. It's beyond comprehension because it is so vast and takes so many different forms. And we're always at times moving towards it. Some group of us are always moving towards not just stupidity towards ourselves, but that's going to affect others, sometimes others for generations of others. Sometimes it will destroy whole cultures. So it's a very tough realm in which to live. The other thing that has affected me, and this I would assume, is having listened to so many people through these years as I've taught retreat. I've listened to thousands of people's stories and how they were dealing with dukkha of one kind or another. And I assume that was also part of this. So understanding and then seeing it in so many people, that this vast wisdom started to somewhat blossom in me. And neither the penetrative wisdom nor the vast wisdom has come to its fruition. It may be as far as I get wherever I am now in each of these, but they're certainly not in terms of the fruition described in the text. So I view it all as a work in progress, and I would suggest to each of you to view yourself as a work in progress. Beware of perfection as your measurement. Perfection is an indicator of the direction we're going in. It is not very useful in any other way as a measurement. So this is what we're cultivating. This is our goal. This is our moment-to-moment intention. How far we realize those goals are based on so many different causes and conditions that it is simply creating a self if we start measuring ourselves in any kind of a specific way. Well, oh, I'm here, I'm there. And doing a lot of judging of ourselves, as I said, we not do in meditation, or starting to compare ourselves to one another, that is not helpful, nor thinking we can fix ourselves psychologically or physically, and then that's going to just get us right away to our goal, our aspiration. So the idea of perfect wisdom in Buddhism only happens at the level of what's termed the arahant, which is a very high level of realization. And maybe anybody in this room will have this happen in this lifetime, but maybe not. And so the perfection becomes the enemy because it becomes a hidden way of creating a self that's this perfect self, this idealized self, rather than a direction. Is that clear enough to you? It's very important. And that's true in almost everything that we do. Because one trick of practice and one trick of practicing any skill in life is being able to relax. And if we are tense over our imperfection, we're not easily going to be able to relax. So we surrender to the moment, to the here and now, to this moment being like this. And then we move towards our goals with things being the way they are. So the surrender allows the relaxation that that causes us not to go and fight or freeze, and allow us to keep moving. I know a number of you in the room are dealing with various health problems, because I've known you for so many years now. And many of you doing this quite beautifully in terms of surrendering to the health problem as it is and then moving forward as best one is able. It's the same in business. It's the same in anything that you would do. It's the same in trying to bring about political change, trying to bring about social change. This relaxed, clear intention with a clear goal, and then a relaxed movement that starts with surrendering to it's like this right now. It's the way to move. It doesn't mean that we don't work hard. We work very hard, and it doesn't mean that we don't have moments of tension. If we didn't have moments of tension, then we would already be perfect, you see. So we're not measuring ourselves, but we have a clear intention as to how to relate. And so we remember that. This is sati, the Pali word for mindfulness, has in it the implication of smirti, is M-I-R-T-I, which is remembering. So we have to remember. There's mindfulness is remembering what? Remembering what our intention is moment to moment, which involves then having a goal, having a clear aspiration as to how we want to meet life, what we wish to do in life and so forth, how we wish to meet our loved ones, how we wish to be with our friends and be with all human beings, be with the earth. This clear sense of how we wish to relate. And then what do? We do as best as we're able. And that's the humility part of this. As best I am able. Compassion is so helpful, maybe necessary for as best I am able. There's a humility in it, but the humility without the compassion can so easily fall into a kind of self-hatred or losing any hope, any faith in ourselves, any sense of possible. So this is this sense of compassion is so important. The Four Noble Truths are described in the text as the elephant's footprint. The elephant's footprint. And this is an analogy, or analogy, the elephant's footprint is so large that it comprises any other animal's footprint. And so the teachings of the Four Noble Truths are so large, so vast, so inclusive that they encompass any other of the Buddhist teachings. Likewise, the elephant's foot is so heavy, it creates such depth in the ground that it has this depth that would include all of any kind of depth of teaching. So the breadth of teachings and the depth of teaching, it's the Buddha's, the Four Noble Truths are the Buddha's elephants, or like the elephant, the footprint of the elephant. In living the Dharma in daily life, we don't have to be so identified with how am I doing, or some larger identification that is really difficult to have and not be creating a self that's having it. Not be creating an ego self that's having that larger identity. And being available to do our practice in walking around practice, when you're in a meeting, when you're on the telephone, you know, when you're walking down the street, when you're talking with your friends, you know, when you're in bed with your significant other, if you have a significant other, then all of those are just times of practice. At first, when we start to get this, if we go on retreat, if retreat's a respite, and maybe we get a little lesson or two, but mostly it's a respite. Oh, we live another way. There's a better way to live, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. And then we start to, then the next step is we start to really bring things back to daily life. And the next step is that we say, oh, I really want to practice in daily life. And then the next step is, oh, daily life is just practice. I'm still on retreat. I got this all confused. It's an artificial division. There's no difference. It's the same mind whether it's in practice or not. It has the same thoughts. It has the same wants. It's the same mind. The conditions are different. The conditions on a retreat are more favorable for us to cultivate both kinds of wisdom. But it's the same mind. It's the same heart. We don't switch going into practice, into retreat practice. And so we have this opportunity to do so much practice if we open up to this view, this understanding that all of life is practice. So many people tell me, including people who are teaching the Dhamma, about their remorse about not having a sitting practice, you know, at home, that a daily practice. And always my response is, well, but what are you doing with the rest of the hours of your day? Are you really practicing there? And I get really mixed answers. I don't think that our community has not understood. Those who are teaching the Dhamma haven't conveyed this sufficiently, or I don't know what the causes are, but I don't really feel as though this is understood, that your walking around practice is the way you're going to, the way you're mostly going to cultivate these two kinds of wisdom. That's how you're going to do it. But it means that you diligently choose to, you're having an experience and you reframe it. You reframe it. You have to actively reframe it until such point that it starts to reframe itself. I have reframed thousands of experiences in daily life. Thousands of them. And there's thousands more that I didn't think to do. I took the narrative, I took the soap opera version of it and lived it all out. Sometimes to my great regret. But nonetheless, there's been those thousands of times I've reframed the experience from seeing through Dharma eyes. You know what I mean by reframing? Mm-hmm. You change the lens that you're looking. You're seeing from a different window, a different perspective. It is so powerful to do this. Most of you that have been here for a long time, I look out here and I see so many faces that, you know, from the early years of this Sangha, you have plenty of practice. You have plenty of practice. That is not the problem. The problem is not having found the way to the commitment. And so it becomes a koan. How do I find the way to commit to living my life more and more as Dharma moments rather than as soap opera moments? Soap opera moments, it's am I winning or losing? Whose fault is it? You know, am I getting my turn? Whatever it is. Those things aren't wrong, but if they're all our life is, it so limits our life. And so we have to have enough familiarity with the teachings of the Buddha, because We don't know how to frame it. We don't know how to reframe a moment if we haven't been exposed to a certain amount of teaching. But nowadays, because of Dharma Seed and all these other Dharma Seed, where you can get all these tapes, and then all these websites, to include my own Dharma Wisdom website, so many teachings everywhere that we can learn the basic teachings, and so many books, there are lots of good books. We don't really have an excuse. We really don't. And yes, I know how busy you are. I'm busy like that too. And so that's the call, and at least that's the teaching for tonight, is to step forward in this way. Knowing what we're cultivating really matters. That it might make a difference is enough. Might make a difference in what way? In your sense of well-being. In your sense of not being so afraid of the world or in battle with the world or whatever it is. That it something like that that can make that difference to you. And it is the faith, just this faith that it might be possible. And remember, always the invitation of the Buddha was, "Ei pasiko, come see for yourself. Don't believe me, come see for yourself." To go to a further level in practice deliberately, it takes a real commitment. And so you have to kind of have a coach in your little inner coach to help you do this and be somewhat willful to go to that next level in a deliberate way. If one keeps practicing, and no matter how, there's some degree of things that just evolve in their own. And at some other time in the next year, I think I'm going to talk about that, about how things can unexpectedly flower. I've had that experience in the last 6 months of something flowering out of nowhere, which I didn't ever considered practicing, not once. Was I deliberately practicing it in the way I'm saying you need to practice something to have it come forward? I was practicing something else, but something just came forward on its own. So, as best I am able, as an orientation, can bring a dignity to your life. Because you're not based your sense of self-esteem, of integrity, on someone else's view of you or your judging mind's view of you. You feel the truth of that I do as best I am able. I know what that means, and I do that. This is the one thing I can say. I have clarity as to goal and moment-to-moment intention. And I know why I have chosen this, and I do as best I am able. That's what I have. That is my offering. That is my qualification. More than all of the study, more than all that I've been exposed to, that is my qualification for sitting here taking your time, is that I live that. I live as best I am able. And again, sometimes it is not something very heartening to witness. And other times, it's really like, look at that. How did this happen? And one example of this is in this whole time that these 2 months of the pain and during the first month of all of this, everything took so long, and if I had to sleep in a different place, so if I forgot to turn off the lights, it took me 20 minutes to get into bed safely. So then I'd have to get back up, go turn off the lights, get back in bed all over again, and this sort of thing. No emotional disturbance. No emotional disturbance. Now, did I think, oh, I'm not supposed to have any emotional disturbance? Not at all. It arose from the practice. From that moment when I felt that switch 10 minutes after it occurred, something just switched, and I was free in relation to this entire experience. That's an amazing thing to say. To put it in a context so you don't think, oh, wow, isn't he wonderful? During this whole period of time, these same 2 months, I have had many disturbances in relation to things in the world, where those things in the world, my mind did go into contraction. It did go into grasping. It did go into clinging to view and so forth. So it wasn't that my mind was in this great serenity the whole time, but this experience has not been an emotional experience for me. It's not been an emotional experience. It's been a physical experience, the end. Now, wisdom, the wisdom of compassion in this regard has gone up and down. So I taught a change and transition workshop weekend, and I was so surprised how exhausted I became doing that, because it was not, I didn't think it was that much work, but I had the first intimations on the last day. I was so tired, just on a weekend, that I was so tired it was making me sick. You know what that's like? Many of you have had that. And so then 5 days later, 6 days later, I went and taught the concentration retreat, and a wonderful retreat. We had a great time. Some of you were here in that. And I would, every day in the afternoon, I would start to crash. And it was the worst experience of that I've ever had teaching a retreat, to the point that I would be most evenings worthless. So by sometime between 2:30 and 4 o'clock, this wave of fatigue would hit me. And if I didn't just stop everything, it would get worse and worse. And I would be so fatigued, I was nauseated and so forth. That wasn't wise that I kept doing that. But I did, once I went, I 3 days before I did the retreat, I thought, you know, maybe I should try to find somebody who could do this for me. And I said, oh no, I can just do the one. Okay. I rationalized away. I was clinging to my story. And then I just finished a 4-day retreat where I sat with the Venerable Inalio, wonderful retreat. And on this retreat, they had sent around a thing saying, what was a yogi job you would want on retreats? All the attendees of the retreat take cooking jobs, cutting vegetables, cleaning toilets, or something, so that we're taking care of ourselves on retreat. It's a wonderful practice, this yogi job practice. You sign me up for something that I can, just because I only have one arm to use. So I got to the retreat, and there were 4 of my colleagues standing outside where we were signing in for our yogi jobs. And they said, Philip, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm going to go see what my yogi job is. They said, you cannot have a yogi job. You can't do that. And watching me hedge, just get dodgy. And I finally, though, I said, well, maybe you're right. And, okay, I'll bring it up. And one of those 4 said, no, we all need to march in there with you and tell the person signing up he cannot have a yogi job. We can't trust you, Philip. And then the others were kind of like, so they didn't come. Lo and behold, I go inside, and I say, you know, my colleagues were telling me I shouldn't have a yogi job. Already switching, right? Was I claiming my own truth? No. I was claiming somebody else's truth. And did that work? No. The person said, oh, but we don't have anybody else. And, And so I said, oh, I'll do it. And then, my job was cleaning the tables that we eat on. And I thought, okay, I can do that, okay. But it turned out that a lot of the tables had actually not been that well cleaned and in the past. And so there was a lot of really, to get it clean. And one of our members here, Sarah, witnessed those tables after I'd cleaned them. They were very clean, right, Sarah? But the trouble was my ribs are so messed up that to do that was agony. And the agony, again, but the agony wasn't that big a deal because it was neither sharp nor that round nor constant. So, you know, all of the same things I described. But it brought up that fatigue. So I ended up in that fatigue state in the morning. And that was a lack of wisdom. So then did I announce that, go in and say, no, I can't do this yogi job? No. Probably because of you, Sarah.
I actually worked out to do it for you. I had no intentions of having you do that job. But, you know, when I went down and started doing tables, I went to somebody and said, what happened here?
So that night they called and said, hey, you know, would you like to not have a yogi job? And I appreciated their calling. But I still did not claim for, I had not claimed for myself saying I shouldn't be doing this. This is lacking vast wisdom. And I'm telling this about me rather than telling it about one of you. But we all will lack self-compassion at times, right? I fail in self-compassion because of my mistrust of myself that I will be a slacker if I get to thinking that way. And I definitely don't want to be a slacker. That's still holding on to an identity. The second problem is that I am attached to carrying my piece of any load. I don't like not carrying my share of a load. That's just an identity. Nobody cared. It's all in my head. Those are the kinds of issues in terms of compassion for myself that I have to work with. What are yours? What are yours? In you living the Dharma in daily life, in the vast wisdom facet of wisdom, what are yours for your self-care? In my daily life, in terms of seeing the dukkha, seeing the end of dukkha, and so forth, seeing suffering, the end of suffering, my struggle is of a different kind. My struggle is of, how would I put this? If it's towards myself, I can witness it and not respond. I cannot move to the vast wisdom from seeing the dukkha sometimes. And that's in relation to myself. So I don't know what yours would be in relation to the penetrative part. But there is one. How, when you see suffering in yourself, do you get the inside of it? No, this is my clinging, this... You know, can you see the why of it? Can you see that? Can you open to the truth? No, this is just dukkha. This is the ego creating the dukkha. That second arrow where it's not just that something's difficult, but we react to it. Likewise, when you're thinking of your compassion for others, what is it that would tend to block your compassion? Is it because of feeling like that they have more? Is that when your compassion gets blocked? Is it when that you feel as though you're too busy? That you don't have time? You've already given it the office or you've already given it home, so you don't have time, you don't have room. You spent all of your compassion dollars so you can't at home, so you can't give compassion in the office or so forth, or out on the highway. You know, so that we understand, we look at ourselves to understand What is in the way of me living the Dharma in daily life? We ask, we're inquiring. We're inquiring, and that's not judging. It's not comparing. It's discerning wisdom that has this penetrative quality and this compassion quality. That's the discerning wisdom. And those two together allow us to live a life that actually has more dignity. And I would argue, I've had many people argue with me, but I would argue more effective in whatever you're trying to accomplish in, as a householder in life. I would argue that. I've seen lots of examples of it, but people sometimes tell me that I'm just full of it about that. So I give you both sides of that view. So I want to just finish this with this little, this is a poem I've read in here and I've read in Poetry Day, but it really captures something about this that, that I'm hoping you will open to. And it has to do with this compassion, this vast wisdom. And it's the Tony Hoagland poem that, by now, again, some of you are quite familiar with, What Narcissism Means to Me. But hear it with fresh ears. Hear it in terms of, oh, there's something about this thing of compassion in here that Philip thinks that we haven't fully received yet. So, beginner's mind. There's socialism and communism and capitalism, said Neil. And there's feminism and hedonism, and there's Catholicism and bipedalism and consumerism. But I think narcissism is the system that means the most to me. And Sylvia said that in Neil's case, narcissism represented a heroic achievement in positive thinking. And Anne, who calls everybody sweetie pie, whether she cares for them or not. Anne lit a cigarette and said, only miserable people will tell you that love has to be deserved. And when I heard that, a distant chime went off for me, remembering a time when I believed that I could simply live without it. Neil had grilled the corn and sliced the onions into thick white discs and piled the wet green pickles up in stacks like coins, and his chef's cap was leaning sideways like a mushroom cloud. Then Ethan said that in his opinion, if you're going to mess around with self-love, you shouldn't just rush into a relationship. And Sylvia was weeping softly now, looking into her wine cooler and potato chips. And then the hamburgers were done and the sunset in the background started cutting through the, oh goodness, I can't read the Xerox, cutting through the charcoal, exposing their insides, black, streaked, dark red, like a slab of scorched, rare, but delicious, but unhealthy, or depending on your perspective, unhealthy but delicious. The way that deep inside the misery of daily life, love lies bleeding. Love lies bleeding. So, why bother? Why bother understanding compassion on a deeper level? Because deep inside, love lies bleeding. It's there available. Not in what form we think it's going to take, not going to feel like we think it's going to feel, at least in my own explorations of this. But there is this deep abiding aspect of the heart that is available. But to know it with wisdom is different than being sentimental about it. The wisdom brings that out in a different way. We know it in a different way, and in my opinion, it empowers us in a different way. So I went back to my physical therapist. I'd gone once, and I told him about that funny experience with the surgeon about me trying to describe the pain, and he said, "Oh, actually, scientifically, that's correct." He said, this kind of a break you have radiates out in all directions at once. So for you to call it circular would be correct. I was really impressed with that. And so then I came back this time and I was saying, you know, I'm actually feeling okay, but I'm having this fatigue thing that's da-da-da-da-da. And he says, Philip, in just that tone, I told you that this was a very serious break, and you have not listened. And I didn't tell him all these other people had said the same thing that I'd not listened to. And he said, you have been dealing with pain, and you are dealing with pain that is the level of having a knee replacement. And for you to have exhaustion is natural. You are not responding to it. And in that moment, I finally heard it. I finally heard what many people had been saying, that, oh no, I have an injury and it's causing all of these conditions, and it's appropriate that I respond to it wisely, compassionately wisely, but responding with rest, which would be the form the compassion would take in the frame of wisdom. Do you see? It took that long for that to register, despite not having mental resistance in terms of the thing. It just, I'm a person who's going to pull his load. I was sticking to my identity. And that's just the way we are. We have those moments. So let's sit for a moment. Some of you were in the room of the concentration retreat when I did the radiating metta. And at the end of that, one of the yogis said, for the first few days, it felt like we were doing metta, but today it feels like we're being metta. And that is the aspiration. And I had certainly done the teaching that way, to evoke that feeling. So we do metta until the conditions are right, and then we become metta. We become karuna, compassion. We become sympathetic joy. We no longer do it, but we start by doing it, by having an intent of cultivating loving kindness, cultivating compassion, cultivating sympathetic joy, cultivating equanimity. We're doing it because it's practice. And at some points and sometimes, there will not be a sense of doing. There will be a sense of being. So just for a minute here, thinking about yourself the way you did and what's in the way of your self-compassion. Just be, just only 60 seconds. Compassion.